You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
Their spiritual relationship with their country. We also acknowledge that the Kaurna are the custodians of the Adelaide region and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. We also pay respects to the cultural authority of Aboriginal people in all areas of Australia and the Torres Strait. We have a few notices this morning. I'd like to draw to your attention that we have a combined service at Shady Grove next week, so there won't be a service here, there'll be a presence only, and the combined service starts at 11:30, and it'll be using basically the same material as I'm using today, and it's a topic of great relevance to Shady Grove being right in the middle of the bushfire zone. Next Saturday, that's the other one I wanted to highlight, was the working bee here at 12 noon. Cobwebs. There's cobwebs all over the place, our little spider friends are so active. If you could bring a cobweb broom, it'd be even better. This chalice, the light of truth. We light this chalice for the warmth of love. We light this chalice for the energy of action. The words of Mary Ann Moore. Welcome to our service of worship this morning. I'm the lay leader. My name is Jenny Dyster. We're an inclusive community and welcome everyone regardless of their gender identification or preference, ethnic identity or religious persuasion. It doesn't matter whom you love or worship, you will be accepted here. An especially warm welcome to visitors and to people online. If you're online, you can tuck into tea and toast or coffee whenever you wish. But I hope that those present today can stay for tea, coffee and conversation after the service. No toast, but the surface is excellent, and if your smile is wide enough, you might get a spice biggie. The topic for today's service is February Dragon, which is a reference to Colin Tealey's 1965 novel. I was a high school student in the 1960s, and Tealey was tops in South Australia. Filmmakers loved Storm Boy, and there's been at least two films. February Dragon is a devastating and heartbreaking account of the fire season in rural Australia. It wasn't the right sort of dragon for film or TV. And it's no longer a school text, it's a bit dated. And that's where I'm heading. The dragon is no longer confined to February in South Australia. Our fire season goes from November to beginning of November to April. That's half the year. I will instead be drawing on Greg Mullen's book Firestorm, which takes us on a journey from the 1960s to 2021. We're going to start today with a reading.
English-American poet W.H. Auden wrote Musée des Beaux-Arts in 1938, following a visit to the Royal Museum of Fine Arts of Belgium. The poem speaker walked through a gallery contemplating various paintings and admiring their ability to convey the human position towards suffering, that is, indifference. Shortly before his 1938 trip to Brussels, Auden spent 6 months in China during the Second Sino-Japanese War and several weeks at the front line of the Spanish Civil War, so the experience of extreme violence was fresh in his mind when he went to Brussels. Everything in the painting seems to disregard, like Icarus' violent death. The farmer in the foreground might have heard Icarus plunge into the water and cry out, but the event is unimportant to him. The sun continues to shine, the ship sails on placidly, continuing its journey. So here is the poem. About suffering, they were never wrong. The old masters, how well they understood its human position. It takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. How, when the aged are reverently, passionately waiting for the miraculous birth, there always must be children who did not specially want it to happen, skating on a pond at the edge of the wood. They never forgot that even the dreadful martyrdom must run its course. Anyhow, in a corner, some untidy spot where the dogs go with their doggy life, and the torturous horse scratches its innocent behind on a tree. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The ploughman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but to him it was not an important failure. The sun shone as it had on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on.
I chose that poem because the reality of bushfire is so immediate when we're in it, and so remote when we're not. It's our tradition to share the significant events of our spiritual lives, joys and concerns, in an open form of fellowship. I invite you now to deepen and to bind that relationship by sharing any recent events being significant in your spiritual life. Light a candle from our chalice and tell us briefly about it. You may light a candle in silence. Listening with an open heart and mind is the most important part of this practice, and as is our custom, I'll light the first candle, and my candle is for those who live in fear in the Ukraine, and for those like Alex who have a close connection with that country. before the war in Ukraine broke out. Like war, bushfire, it's not a feel-good topic in Australia. But what persuaded me to continue was the memory of our Prime Minister saying, as fires raged across the country in 2019 and 20, I'm focused on the needs of the people in this room today, before offering his thoughts and prayers. Emergency Management Minister said it was not the time for a conversation by people who wanted to politicise climate change. New South Wales Premier rebuffed journalists by saying, not today. The Deputy Prime Minister accused those of asking about the link between fires and climate change of being in the city raving lunatics. Of course, bushfires were a perfect time to talk about cricket, which was sure to give communities and firefighters something to cheer for. It also wasn't time to discuss a Royal Commission into the fires. Which begs the question, when is the time? Well, the answer's clear now. We're having a warm day today, because we've had so many days in the low 20s right through December, January and February, it even feels a bit hot. What a lovely, damp, cool summer we've had in Adelaide. My garden loves it. The weeds love it even more. And I've really enjoyed being able to be active right through the day instead of having to skulk indoors in the air conditioning. In a normal February, a day with a maximum of 30 would be seized upon as a day of blessed relief after a run of plus 40s. So in the absence of plus 40s and desiccating north winds, let's talk fire. On the screen in front of you is a photo of a man labelled by the Murdoch Press a mere urban firefighter with no background in bush firefighting. The man in the photo is Greg Mullins. By the time he was described as an ex-fire chief commenting on areas outside his expertise about an alleged relationship between bushfires and climate change, he'd retired after 50 years of service and for 14 years had been the commissioner of one of the world's largest fire services, Fire and Rescue, New South Wales. When it came to natural disasters, there was little, if anything, he hadn't witnessed firsthand. Now the ex-fire chiefs were speaking up because the actual fire chiefs already had their hands full with the unfolding of the 2019 season. The problem was they knew it was going to be a stinker, and the federal government had been continually denying a standing request from fire chiefs to update the funding originally committed in 2003. Furthermore, the process to access military assistance was outdated, convoluted and slow. Now, of course, our constitution puts the states and territories in charge of emergency response. But during a national emergency, the federal government has powers and is expected to assist. So Greg Mullins in April made a request to speak to the Prime Minister on behalf of ELCA, Emergency Leaders for Climate Action. The reply from the Prime Minister curiously thanked Greg Mullins for congratulating him on his election win, but made no acknowledgement of the issues and referred to the matter to other ministers, none of whom responded until extreme pressure from the press impelled the Emergency Management Minister to, quote, reach out and offer a 20-minute meeting with no other ministers present. This meeting didn't happen until December. That's 8 months after the original request, and it was longer than 20 minutes, it was an hour, with two ministers. Meanwhile, the Prime Minister was too busy. The leader of the opposition was firmly rebuffed when he called for a bipartisan approach. It was that Christmas that the PM went to Hawaii and made the infamous comment, I don't hold a hose, mate, and I don't sit in the control room. What a contrast to the previous Prime Minister of the same political persuasion. Greg Mullins says of Tony Abbott, he's a very good firefighter. He's someone you want beside you, quite frankly. I've had people say, how can you even speak to him? And my thing is, there's too much hate in Australian politics. I think personality politics some play is disgusting, and I don't want to be part of that, having experienced it myself. Last year, Greg Mullins produced a memoir called Firestorm, and it was published by Penguin Books. It begins with his earliest memory in 1964 when he woke up with a start. He was 5 years old. He heard the sound of dry gum leaves brushing against each other and heard the sigh of the wind through the casuarinas. He sniffed the air coming through his bedroom window. There was no smoke, so he knew he didn't have to go and wake up Mum and Dad. At 5 years of age, he already knew of the dangers of west winds in the northern outskirts of Sydney. His dad was a volunteer firefighter and senior works supervisor for the Department of Public Works. And his mum knew all the common and botanical names of the native trees and wildflowers. They'd pull up invasive weeds on family walks. Over time, he became very aware of the original inhabitants' footprint on this part of the country because of the artifacts, rock paintings and etchings. In addition, his dad taught him about seasons, not the white urban kind that are dictated by the calendar, but seasons signalled by the natural environment as Indigenous people observed. His dad taught him to observe the weather, the behaviour of ants, when cicadas and bogong moths and Christmas beetles arrive, and how to gauge soil dryness by the leaves of trees. Dad was rarely home when the fires were close and would come home blackened, red-eyed and smoky and exhausted for sleep. He was Greg's hero, and he decided that's what he wanted to be. The story of his first fire is told in the prologue. It started with a phone call from his brother's best friend. His mum and dad were away, he and his sister were home alone and the fire was heading for them. So a rake, a hoe, a shovel, an axe, old sacks, watering cans and buckets were slung into the family car. His dad donned overalls, a felt hat and heavy boots. "Hurry up," he said to Greg, "you better get dressed." Mum wasn't very impressed, but off he went in long pants, a long-sleeved shirt, hat and a heavy pair of gardening gloves. He was 12. Now, you could join the minor brigades at this time, at age 13, and he did a year later in 1972. His older brother, Terry, helpfully advised him, "They're desperate, they'll take anyone." He wasn't allowed to join his dad's brigade till he was 16. Now, in the 1960s, local bushfire brigades were equipped with converted army Chevrolets and Ford Blitz wagons fitted out with tanks, pumps and hoses. They were great off-road, but they were slow. The crews dressed in jeans, overalls and felt hats. Helmets were rare. In the brigade that Greg joined, there were only two helmets. One of the shed's most reliable bits of technical equipment was an old blackboard. Chalked on it. "Bushfire at West Head. Have dinner and meet at the shed, 7 p.m. Popped against a tree. In the 70s, larger tankers began to replace the old ex-World War II vehicles and more sirens were installed. In 1977, on the Davies HSC biology exam, Greg had his first brush with death. He responded to a call out after school and was positioned to try and stop a fire from jumping up to a hillside from whence it would go all over. Spot fires proliferated and retreat was inevitable. When the call came, Greg's return to the truck was blocked by a wall of flame. Two fires were joining. Now the flames were 10 metres high, so the maths is you'd have to run through 30 metres horizontally to get to the other side of the fire front. That's not possible. So he found where a truck had been bogged and lay in a wheel rut and scooped sand over his back. The fire sucked up all the oxygen and when he eventually got a breath it burned his throat. "Mum's going to kill me," he thought. And then, "Shit, I was going to apply to join the fire brigade full time next week." And then he passed out. The next thing he heard was the F word. And there was a hand on his shoulder, and he turned up to his head to see the deputy fire control officer, eyes full of tears. "Come on, Scruff, wake up, we've got work to do." Why Scruff? Just amazing at what they wore, the lack of protection. That's a modern, by contrast, a modern firefighter with all the helmet and the special clothing and the power pack for hose. But that's why it was called Scruff. He sported an afro. The following year he went to the barber and said, "Make me look like a firefighter. I'm a barber, mate, not a magician." Said the barber. Greg sat an entrance exam and was told, "You do realise if we let you in, you have to have a haircut, don't you?" He was shattered. He already felt bald. Undeterred, he worked his way up the ranks and by 1991 scored his dream job. Sydney Region Hazard Reduction Officer. No longer on shift work. He was able often to spend the weekends with his family, coordinating firefighting operations in summer, hazard reduction in winter. What could possibly go wrong? Someone moved the cheese. Normal wasn't normal anymore. You know normal. Tasmania has a bushfire every 30 years. Victoria has more casualties than New South Wales. Bad fires near Sydney happen once a decade. Drought raises the possibility of a bad season because of dry soil. You get bushfire activity in spring and summer if the winter rains are sparse. The bad fire weather starts in Queensland, sometimes as early as August, and then it shifts progressively south, meaning there's plenty of warning when things might get interesting. Now in the second half of 1993, there were fires that spread fast and generated spot fires in unusual locations. There was much discussion about fire behaviour, but then November brought really good rain, so everyone relaxed. Greg and his family went on holiday at Christmas time, one of the perks of the new job. The kids had a great time shooting the rapids in a blow-up boat that Santa had delivered. They did long hikes on Barrington tops, and on January the 4th they drove to the top of the range to hike. There was a west wind and smoke columns about 20 kilometres away, and Greg started to feel jumpy. These are typical of the lightning strikes or the fires you get at that time. The next day he left his phone number at the local shop, and 2 days later a bloke in a four-wheel drive came to Greg's campsite and said, "Bring Sydney." They returned lickety-split, and the very next day there were massive fires to fight. 800,000 hectares were scorched, people lost their lives, 200 homes gone, fire crews imported from interstate and the rest of New South Wales. The point was though, not that there were record losses for New South Wales. The point was, even old hands like Greg's dad hadn't seen this one coming. I mean, he observed weather and nature as they had unerringly for years in the past. But the weather conditions were extreme and unexpected. In hindsight, that was years later, Greg realised this season was not an outlier. Weather and climate were changing for the worse with increasing carbon dioxide levels. In 1994, he went on a study trip to Spain and the USA. The story was the same. Recent fires have been more widespread, more intense. He was very impressed by the use of military aircraft in the States, as the Rocky Mountains are too steep and they're also full of rattlesnakes, which get in the way of firefighting. Not all the efforts of the Americans were high-tech though. They were starting to use goats and temporary fencing to create fire breaks or reduce fuel loads. Now in 1997, serious fires happened again near Sydney. In 2002, there were massive, unprecedented fires. The word unprecedented became ludicrous because every year something new and unprecedented seemed to happen. In 2003, Canberra gained the dubious honour of being the site of one of the world's first recorded tornadoes, fire tornadoes. 200 kilometres per hour and a sustained fire spread of 20 kilometres per hour, yet another record. Now, John Howard responded by agreeing to a cost-sharing agreement between the states and territories to fund the leasing of a larger range of firefighting aircraft. Even more important was he funded the establishment of the Bushfire Cooperative Research Centre, which operated till 2014, producing improvements in equipment, uniforms, decision-making, predictive models. In 2009, Victoria experienced a heat wave with temperatures exceeding 43 for days, and Melbourne almost hit 47. The fire in King Lake killed 159 people. The fires were unstoppable. The flame front was likened to a nuclear explosion, generating 880,000 watts per metre. Aircraft become ineffective in extreme conditions, but where their value is in preventing the extremes, because all big fires start from small fires. In 2013, the drought in Tasmania caused the power cuts as the hydro scheme faltered, and Hobart recorded a high of 41.8. This is a state where the locals refer to temperatures in the high 20s as hot. Alpine and rainforest, formerly considered fireproof, burned freely. Any suggestion, though, at this stage, that New South Wales would soon experience property losses on a scale dwarfing Tasmania and Victoria would have been scoffed at, because the confluence of drought, weather and fuel load had not been experienced before. In the black summer of 2020 in New South Wales, 3 billion native animals killed. Yet we still have federal politicians claiming that inner-city greenies are making it all up. The greenies stopped hazard reduction burning. We've had weather conditions like this before. It's cyclical. The fires were started by arsonists. Nothing to do with climate change. Grazing in national parks will reduce the fuel loads. Oh, we've had worse fires before. These are all ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous myths. Just as silly as the idea that the Greenies are making it all up. Greg Mullins gives much of the credit to his own growing belief that climate change is responsible, not to the Greens, but to the farmers, for whom weather and climate are vital. He had many heartfelt discussions with people on the land while firefighting in their country. I recommend to you Mullins' book, Firestorm. Oops. Yeah, it's hard to remain indifferent to the issues when you read first-hand account of events written by people with a passion for observation and problem-solving rather than politics or self-aggrandisement. People are still paying a high price for speaking up about climate change. There are many personal attacks. It's a difficult issue to think about because we don't want to suffer. We don't want to be fearful or stressed. And seriously, we do need to look after ourselves. Too much news can plunge us into the depths of despond. That one plunged me into the depths of despond. That's the Nazarene photo of the big fires in 2019-20. How do we deal with this kind of negativity? Fear, anxiety and frustration. It's not self-generated and it's not about us. Bad stuff happens. We cannot spend our lives avoiding problems because they cause us stress. There are actions we can take. We can vote politicians out of office if they sprout rubbish. We can put our concerns to our state and federal members. If there's a demonstration of support for people who do care about the issues, we can turn out and sign petitions, write letters or emails. But there are also things we can do to protect ourselves. Firstly, we can apply the principle of the serenity prayer and work out what we need to accept because it can't be changed, what needs courage and action to change, and to use our own logic plus discussion with others to work out the difference between what we can and cannot fix or work toward improving. And of course what I've got on the screen there is the traditional formulation of the serenity prayer, and the one on the right is more suitable for atheists because it's not asking God to do the mental work. Another thing we can do to protect ourselves is to create routines. There are probably two times a day when, unless you're actually in the midst of a life-threatening crisis, you should cocoon yourself from news and engagement with difficult issues. And those two times are first thing in the morning and last thing at night. Setting up a positive start for the day can increase your resilience and energy. Some decisions are non-brainers. Do you check your emails or bung the news on before your eyes are fully open? Or should you make a cuppa and gaze out into the garden? Take a stroll, walk, run, swim? Or just do breakfast before engaging in the vicissitudes of life? If you meditate or pray in the morning, when's the best time to do it? Personally, if I try and meditate first thing, I go back to sleep. My trick is to have a cuppa and go outside on the veranda. Similarly, at the end of the day, bedtime routines can be orchestrated with calm of mind. Now, for the time between go and slow. This has to do with regulating our actual engagement. And I think it's the two cues we need to consider, quantity and quality. How many times do we need to listen to the news? The 24-hour news cycle involves a lot of repetition, and self-discipline can be applied to regulate screen time. There are news services that are more objective and more measured than others. There are news services that aren't aimed at raising righteous indignation, and there are writers and commentators who are more inspirational than others, or more directed to action than analysis. Uplifting material need not be pie in the sky. I avoided Firestorm for a year before I read it, having lived in a bushfire-prone region, and I lived through three major fire events in the last 40 years. However, a friend told me it was a great read. It was a great read for the history, for the anecdotes and reflections, and above all, it's nice to know that there are people like this in contemporary Australia, competent, informed and caring. This screenshot is of Greg Mullins in retirement. He's joined the local fire service as a volunteer. Hubris ain't ever been his problem. What an inspiration this man is. And when you read about people like this, it helps you feel better, not worse, about the possibilities of doing good in a very imperfect world. Before we do the benediction, just a little reminder that the cash point and wooden chalice are there for contributions, which we really need because we're an independent, not-for-profit, self-governed church, and we do rely on your contributions. Now, would you like to stand for the benediction? I'm taking the words from an American minister who has appeared here, it was Maureen Caloran. No matter how weak or frightened we may feel, we each have gifts that can make a difference in the world. In this coming week, may you do at least one thing to support the broken, to welcome the stranger, to celebrate what is worthy. to do work of justice and love. Be strong. Be connected. Every day act so you may be a little more whole.
We hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing UnitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.